Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We should point out Ian will be here all week in Jim's stead. And we have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives. And it might be in the eye of the beholder whether our first two martinis are good or bad. Some will think one is better than the other, probably. And both of them deal with two major appointments that Donald Trump made official on Sunday, and that's that current RNC chairman, Reince Priebus, who, if you're keeping track of wins and loss records, I guess Ian sports a, what would you say, 2-1 record as chairman of the RNC. This is his third election cycle, and he did very well in the last two. 2012, not quite as good. And he'll be the new chief of staff. And that means that Stephen Bannon, the former head of Breitbart News, who became, I believe it was campaign CEO, is going to stay on, but not in the top job in the administration. But he'll be pretty high up. He'll be senior counselor and chief strategist for the Trump administration. So this is interesting on a number of levels, Ian. Basically, Trump is trying to marry the two wings of right-thinking people, I mean right politically, obviously, that got him elected. Obviously, many of the Republicans ended up coming home, some of them reluctantly. Priebus is someone who helped shepherd Trump through a rules fight at the convention. He probably ended up steering him right in his multiple spats with Paul Ryan, who Priebus is very close to. And so he'll be the guy who I think is designed to negotiate with the leaders up on Capitol Hill, and Steve Bannon will probably be the one to show the grassroots who don't trust the Republican establishment that Trump is on their side, and he'll probably wage part of the media strategy. So let's start with Priebus here. Some say his organization, the RNC, shows he's good for this. He's got a great relationship with Paul Ryan. Others, of course, are worried about whether or not he's got the ear of the grassroots and so forth that don't necessarily trust the Republican leadership. So first of all, let's talk about Priebus. What do you think of that choice?
Yeah, so I think you're general sense of things is probably correct in the way that these two will interact. With Priebus, first of all, it's encouraging. So the sort of early thought was, well, maybe Bannon will be the chief of staff, which would be a terrible idea, in part because Bannon doesn't have that organizational background, and Priebus does. And so it's encouraging that he went with Reince for the chief of staff because he's that type of organizational functionary who can, you know, put the pieces in the right place. Reince will be, you know, sort of the guy keeping the schedule and obviously doing a whole lot more, and also be doing some of that outreach with Congress, where, as you say, he has generally good relationships with Republicans, et cetera. That represents to me, or it suggests to me, that there is at least a general sense within the transition team of needing people with experience doing a difficult, complex political job. And Reince has that. And, you know, we all thought he made a terrible mistake by, we all being me and some others probably, thought that he had made a bad decision jumping so eagerly onto Trump's bandwagon during the campaign. But it's obviously worked out and had long coattails. So I think this is a position for which Reince is actually well suited. Additionally, it's not too worrisome to me that this is the type of thing that's going to ruffle populist Republicans' feathers, in part because the chief of staff is really not that visible a personage. I mean, we all knew Rahm Emanuel, but that was in part because Rahm Emanuel sort of made himself known.
Right.
You know, if Reince sort of lowers his head and goes about the job and tries to work to bring together, I think, Trump and a much wiser Congress, which is likely the case, then he could be a good fit for this position.
All right, let's move over to Steve Bannon now. And I want to quote the first two paragraphs in the New York Times and get your sense on whether Michael Scheer, Maggie Haberman, and Alan Rappaport think more highly of Reince Priebus than Steve Bannon. Now, let me see what you think here, Ian. President-elect Donald J. Trump on Sunday chose Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican National Committee and a loyal campaign advisor, to be his White House chief of staff, turning to a Washington insider whose friendship with the House Speaker, Paul D. Ryan, could help secure early legislative victories. In selecting Priebus, Mr. Trump passed over Stephen K. Bannon, a right-wing media provocateur. But the president-elect named Mr. Bannon his senior counselor and chief West Wing strategist, signaling an embrace of the fringe ideology long embraced by Mr. Bannon and of a continuing disdain for the Republican establishment. So I think they're more encouraged by one choice than the other, Ian. I don't know if you could read just a little bit of that into this news story here. Steve Bannon obviously has baggage. Breitbart has published some things, and the New York Times, without much prompting, I'm sure, listed a few of them in their story. They see him as a potential race baiter and all sorts of other things here. And Steve Bannon is a larger-than-life, fills-the-room type personality, so it's interesting to see how he'll work with Reince Priebus. But the fact that Trump wants somebody who identifies with the people that don't trust the establishment, it's kind of an interesting compromise here.
Yeah, and I think that's part of it is trying to do some reassuring. But also, you know, it was sort of inevitable that that Bannon was going to have a part in this administration. I mean, he was integral to the late part of the campaign and the strategizing that went on to the extent that it went on in the latter portion of this campaign. So it was inevitable that he was going to have some, you know, type of major position. The question for me is what that influence is going to look like. And this is a question that I'm not sure anybody can answer quite yet. I have been personally very hard on Bannon and very hard on Breitbart because I think that they have given voice to some really ugly sentiments on the right. I mean, Bannon told Mother Jones this summer that he was thrilled that Breitbart had become, quote, the platform for the alt-right. You know, given what I see in my Twitter feed on a daily basis and David French, Eric Erickson and Bethany Shondark Mandel and you know, several others have written about this, that's a deeply distressing fact. This is a small fringe, but a vocal one that is nasty. I don't know to what extent Bannon actually identifies with that versus, you know, simply seeing an opportunity to grow traffic on his site, you know, provoke and inflame and sort of push back against the norms that he sees suffocating our public life. I don't know sort of which of those is true. We'll find out. And if it's, you know, if Bannon does identify with that, then the fact that he's basically sort of what looks to be in a sort of Karl Rove position in a Trump White House is deeply concerning. If it's more the case that Bannon is simply an opportunist and, you know, it will sort of head up the, you know, Trump's crusade against nasty media, which, you know, he's undoubtedly going to get for his administration, then perhaps more sober-minded forces will prevail in terms of actual policy. It's my hope that is the case, not the former.
Ian, I've heard a rumor that somebody who is affiliated with National Review wrote a piece exactly on this issue last week, somebody who talked about the need to try and hope for the best and work for the best with the Trump administration, but never ease up on the alt-right. Do you remember who wrote that piece last week?
Well, as a matter of fact, that piece popped up on Face the Nation yesterday morning, and Newt Gingrich quickly said that was garbage and that Trump's connection to the alt-right was a media fabrication. About 4 hours later, Steve Bannon was appointed chief White House advisor. I think that conservatives, as I wrote, need to be extremely vigilant about this. And that's maybe another thing to add about Bannon. I haven't quite formulated my thoughts, and there will be more on the website later about this. But one of the things that appointing Bannon does is it gives the media an easy target. And we're now in, you know, somewhere in the almost 24-hour range of a just complete media panic. You know, Donald Trump is Hitler and Steve Bannon is his Goebbels. You know, that's not true. At a moment when Donald Trump needs to, you know, trying to bring the country together, trying to calm some of the unrest that's out there, appointing Bannon does sort of fan the flames. Now, you know, maybe in the long run it'll turn out to be a, you know, a blip on the radar that is easily forgotten. We'll see. But right now, it has a lot of people people deeply distressed and makes the transition easier to sort of denounce very early on.
So Trump trying to cover all his bases with top personnel. He's also trying to cover his bases with policy, and we'll get to that a little bit later in the week. We're not going to talk about that here today, but the 60
Minutes.
Oh, come
on. Yeah. Well, I mean, Greg, why waste time on policy? I mean, yeah.
There's so many other exciting things to do. But while the Republicans are putting together a new administration and continuing majorities in the House and Senate on Capitol Hill, the Democrats, well, they're not doing so well. The Democrats, of course, are mainly protesting and destroying the property of people in large cities who probably voted for Hillary Clinton, if they voted at all, since most of the big cities were overwhelmingly Democratic. You still got the college students being forgiven midterm exams and given safe spaces to deal with the fact that they didn't win. You've got people as high up as Eric Holder and Michael Dukakis now calling for the abolition of the Electoral College. And so things are not mentally well on the Democratic side. But apparently the way to cope with that is by doing nothing to change your leadership. Instead of, as even folks like Michael Moore have suggested, hey, maybe go out and talk to some working class people, see why they're struggling, see why they're upset, see why they're abandoning the Democrats that they voted for all these cycles. Well, here's the plan in the House of Representatives. Washington Post. House Democrats close to Nancy Pelosi are circulating a letter within the Democratic Women's Caucus pledging support for the California Democrat to remain House Democratic leader amid growing frustration at the party's disastrous showing in Tuesday's election. The letter, written by California Congresswoman Doris Matsui, says that Pelosi helped Democrats achieve, quote, historic progress in the lives of women, workers, students, veterans, seniors, and LGBT Americans, unquote, according to a copy of it obtained by the Washington Post. As of Friday afternoon, 40 of the 54 women had signed the letter, according to aides. Still goes on, quote, we believe that now more than ever, our caucus and our country need your strategic, battle-tested leadership to guide us through the years ahead. As we work to guard our accomplishments for hardworking families and preserve an inclusive and forward-looking America, we will be stronger with you as our Democratic leader. You have our support, and we ask you to continue as the leader for our party and our nation. So Doris Matsui did a good job of dictating exactly what Nancy Pelosi told her to write, it would seem like there, Ian. So Nancy Pelosi, who has been Democratic leader, I believe, since 2003. That would be 14 years and apparently counting here, because as we know, Democrats, for a variety of reasons, are terrified of crossing Nancy Pelosi. So if she wants to run and have this job again, she's most likely going to get it, especially since the person most likely to challenge her, Steny Hoyer, is even older than her. She's 76. He's 77. And if that weren't enough, after the debacle at the DNC this year with Debbie Wasserman Schultz found in the WikiLeaks to be actively aiding Hillary Clinton in the primaries, and then the interim DNC chair, Donna Brazile, feeding questions to Hillary Clinton, obviously there's going to be a change there. And the guy getting a lot of attention from the likes of Bernie Sanders and Harry Reid, who can't go away fast enough, is Keith Ellison, the Muslim congressman from Minnesota, who is a firebrand, to say the least, very hardcore left on a number of issues. And I'm not sure, Ian, that he's necessarily the guy who's going to bridge back the divide with the working class here that abandoned Democrats. So on the one hand, they're going further to the left with the DNC. And on the other hand, they're doing absolutely nothing different with Nancy Pelosi.
Let's start with Pelosi. What on earth do you have to do to lose your job in Democratic Party politics? I mean, she has presided over catastrophic losses to the Democratic Party. I'm a University of Texas Longhorn football fan. The UT football program is far more ruthless with its coaches than the Democratic Party of the United States. I mean, and that's true. Almost any sports program is willing to toss out someone who's not performing. I mean, Nancy Pelosi hasn't been 500 in her tenure heading up the Democrats' House conference. Also, for all of the noise that was made about Republicans being this party of old white people, when you have Nancy Pelosi fighting with Steny Hoyer to be the minority leader, I mean, come on. It's indicative of basically a Democratic reaction to Trump's election that says what we really need to do is hunker down. And that's true of Ellison as well. And I will just point people in the direction of Scott Johnson over at Powerline Blog, who's been following Keith Ellison's career for many years, since Scott is based in the Twin Cities and Ellison is from up that way. There's a lot in Ellison's background that raises interesting questions that, you know, really have been entirely glossed over by the media for, you know, reasons of convenience. But more to the point, the central lesson of Trump's victory is a rebuke to the Obama years, and not just the policy initiatives, not just Obamacare and, you know, the things that sort of are hitting people in their pocketbooks, but also, to my mind, the cultural progressivism that the left has tried to shove down people's throats. That is what Ellison is behind 100%. And basically, if they make him, you know, chair of the DNC, what it suggests, it may not prove to be true, but what it strongly suggests is the lesson that the left is prepared to take away from this is that, in fact, what they need to do is double down on the cultural liberalism. That may be sort of baked into the DNA of the left at this point, that, you know, to abandon those things would really be to just sort of abandon the whole enterprise of what they're doing. So, you know, it might be that there's no one who can get away from this impulse. But, you know, if that's not the case, and I'll hedge on that question for the moment, then appointing or, you know, selecting Ellison suggests that they're taking away, taking the exact wrong lesson from this debacle.
Ian, there may be other candidates in the race for DNC chair. The only one I've heard volunteer themselves for nomination is Howard Dean, the former chair, who actually, as crazy as he is, saw some gains in 2006 and 2008. How much of that is due to his leadership, I'm not quite sure. But he is also the guy who, after the first debate, not only said on Twitter, but then doubled down on cable news that he was absolutely convinced that Donald Trump was a coke addict. So pick your poison, Democrats.
One of the things that's interesting about the behind the scenes of the Clinton campaign was we found out that basically the only person in Clinton HQ who understood that the campaign needed to reach out to white working class voters was Bill Clinton. And, you know, Howard Dean is to the left of Bill Clinton, but being his background suggests that there might be the possibility that he would recognize that as well. And in his more sober moments, when he's not insinuating cocaine addictions, he might actually be a little more savvy to that. It just highlights the extraordinary situation the Democrats are in when you and I are sitting here thinking, well, maybe Howard Dean would actually do a better job. They clearly are prepared to further entrench themselves in the ghetto of cultural progressivism, and that's not likely to recoup many losses in 18 or et cetera, assuming that Republicans don't implode.
It's always an interesting assumption. Poor Bill Clinton. It's just too bad he never had access to anyone who could have changed anything about the campaign. It's too bad he had nobody's ear this whole time. What a poor guy.
Well, I'm sure his lawyer could have contacted Hillary's lawyer.
Wouldn't be the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Ian, fun start to the week. Talk to you tomorrow.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today and all this week. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us, and tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.